This is XTP Media.
Hi there, I'm sitting in my car now, just outside the airfield gates. I'm at Hensridge Airfield in Somerset. The last time I was here was two or three years ago to speak to the Light Aircraft Association on our beautiful airfields feature. At the time, I looked across the airfield to see a yellow helicopter, and I asked a few questions about it, but we didn't really talk too much about it. But today's very different because I've come to see that yellow helicopter, or maybe even the green one that came to my rescue 8 weeks ago. I had a silly accident, and unfortunately, being in a rural area, medical help was some way away. And the angels shone upon me, and from the sky swooped down a helicopter from the Dorset and Somerset Air Ambulance. Luckily, had a consultant on board, a paramedic, and they were able to deal with my injury and prepare me for transit to hospital and for surgery. Now, I'm good now. I'm healing really, really well. I will have a graphical memory down my leg, as well as probably in my head, about the whole incident. But the wonderful work that these people do is amazing, because the majority of them are volunteers. The trust, as I understand it, is a charity. So what an amazing thing to do for someone, and how important their role is to people like me who live in rural communities. So today's about going to say thank you, to talk to them, to express my gratitude to them. So I'll take my recorder. I don't know if we're going to record anything or not. We'll see. We'll see how we get on. So here we go. Dorset and Somerset Air Ambulance. Let's go and see these wonderful people.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Takeoff. So, here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to this episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. In today's episode, we go behind the scenes of the Dorset and Somerset Air Ambulance. This is all charitable work, but it's a crucial emergency service to areas like the one I live in. First, I want to say a big thank you, something we'd normally save until the end of the show, but I can't let it go without thanking Owen Hammett, the critical care practitioner, Dr. Farah Mislam, otherwise known as Izzy, and pilot Phil Merritt, who all came to my assistance on July the 8th. Let's get on then in this episode. I probably should also say that during my visit, I was a little emotional, and that does come through in some of the interviews with my excitement and my chattering. Another thing to mention is that we recorded several interviews in a rather cavernous meeting room where the audio's not great. I hope this doesn't spoil your listening experience. But that's it. Let's get on. My first interview was with Owen Hammett, and we start by looking back at my experience. Because as I was just saying to Tracy, the first thing that came into my head when I heard the rotor blades was, please, God, don't be for me. Because my daughter was running around trying to wave down.
Yeah.
Because you couldn't...
Well,
think, what was the pilot's name again?
It was Phil, wasn't it?
Phil Merritt.
You and Izzy.
Me, Izzy and Phil Merritt, yeah.
Yeah.
But see, having spoken to your daughter and your wife whilst you were on your way to hospital, because we ultimately landed in the paddock in your back garden, they were saying, because Jay was an air show, wasn't it, that weekend?
Yeah, that's
been the
right.
Day before.
Yeah.
So your daughter had seen loads of planes, loads of helicopters, and then suddenly there's one in your back garden. And
I know, there was a bit, she's not nonchalant about it, she's very proud of herself, because one of the great things that you guys did was you got her involved, because obviously the first 10 minutes before or 15 minutes before you arrived was sheer chaos. Tea towels, do this, get the neighbours, and every one of our neighbours was out.
So
it was just like, really?
Always the way.
Everyone. Yeah. So when obviously my wife realised that the helicopter was coming and we heard it, she was like, well, where are they going to land? And I was useless. So she sent my daughter out to wave you down. And I don't know how, nobody thought, the paddock was the obvious place anyway, in hindsight.
You would have landed anywhere, wouldn't you? Anyway.
And that's we would have found anywhere. Interestingly, we had the smaller aircraft, which was our reserve aircraft at the time.
Yeah.
So we were, not that that brings us much difficulty in landing, but we just need a slightly bigger space.
Yeah. She is a bit bigger, isn't she?
She is. And the profiles of, Dan's bag, but the profiles that Dan and the other pilots having to fly is slightly different. So, because the paddock's got quite cool tall trees around.
Yeah, it had.
I think we found out. Okay. I can't remember. Oh, I'm trying to record.
You were, I think, from what we've established, you were coming back from a previous call.
Me and Izzy were the duty crew. So Izzy was the doctor for the day.
Right.
The practitioner for the day.
You were returning here, we know that, from, I think, from Dorchester.
But either way, it's not, even if we were here, it's really not far. I think we might have even landed on briefly here, like we'd come back from our last job and we're like refueling here or something like that.
Yeah.
You're right. We were on our way back here, and then for us, it was just a matter of
it was a quick transit.
Just the other side of the high grounds over the road. So
it's
like 7-8 minutes. And I think the difficulty with people like yourself who've had injuries like yours, it's very difficult for your wife or your daughter or you to go, because to you that's a massive thing.
Yeah, no, I understand.
Like life-changing thing, and luckily it isn't a life-changing thing. But
that's partly due to you guys' immediate response, because from what I understand from the surgeons, they kept it open for 24 hours. Which, with hindsight, seems like a macabre sort of thing. But because you were flushing it out.
Yeah.
And what apparently had happened is as the ladder had broke, the aluminium step had gone through my calf and run down the bone. So they weren't sure whether that had broken. But I think the bone had protected, stopped it going any further. But my ladder, being an external ladder and a bit old, was full of crap. And so washing it out and all that made their job much easier, I think, in surgery. I mean, A&E was just like a transit.
Did we hand over to the land crew then, or did you go by the...
So we were first there, because we were so quick. So Izzy and I and Phil were first there.
And the thing that I found surprising, I suppose, but now I think about it, is I've seen you guys in action as a member of the public, and I always wondered why things were so long, you know, because normally you're just saying, put the helicopter down, wrap them up, put them in and go. And it's all about stabilising, and that's I recognise that now, because by the time you guys were ready to make the next move, the ambulance was here, so that must have been 20 minutes, you know, and I didn't realise sometimes it takes that long to do all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, it can be. And it's all kind of, well, it's difficult to explain, isn't it? Everything's kind of on a timeline and a spectrum. So, like, although your injury was bad,
it wasn't life-threatening.
It's really difficult, so we get a phone call and we're sat here. We might have been out and about. I need to find out whether or not. But either way, we get a radio call, a phone call, and we just get told a very brief snippet of information, and that's from your wife or other jobs, it's from a bystander. And even some of the things, like car crashes, people have driven past and all you get is there's a car in a ditch upside down.
Yeah.
You didn't actually get lots of information. So the information we were told for yourself was fallen off a ladder, query a partial amputation of your leg.
Gosh. Okay.
So I think that was right. Now, I can look back on the actual job and see what was coded as. Now, for us, that's an automatic dispatch criteria.
Yeah.
Because that's quite a big deal.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then scaling back from that is ultimately what we have to do. So, like, today we've been to someone, yesterday, you would go out and you think of something, and then actually they're not as bad as you expect. And you have to then, not change tack, but you scale back.
Sure.
You gear up to do one thing, and then actually it turns out that we're doing a completely different thing. So we're not having to manage you bleeding lots, as an example.
Yeah.
We're managing your pain and the fact you've got your dirty ladders going through your leg and you need antibiotics and you need washing out. And we need to make sure you've got your tetanus. Not that we can give that, but it's useful
to know down the line. Pretty
concoction.
Tetanus with the booster at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. So but all those things for you is really, really important.
Yeah.
Because actually, if you waited another hour for an ambulance, which you could have done, in certain circumstances, then like if it got infected, us giving you antibiotics really early on.
Does that make such a difference? It can make such a difference. Really?
Especially with very dirty wounds like yourself.
Yeah.
Or even medical problems. So if you had a chest infection, which was what the word, you might have heard it recently in the news, septic. It's quite a big political sepsis, which is what you used to call septicemia.
Yeah.
If you had blood infection, it's kind of the easy way they described it. Like every hour for those really sick patients makes a difference to whether you survive or not.
Yeah.
And you didn't have a raging, it wasn't infected at that point.
No.
But the earlier we can start your body to gear up to treat the infection means that you don't get things like septicemia, and then you don't end up having an injury that it might even just be a scratch. Like I've got a scratch on my arm now somewhere. Now there's no reason why that couldn't become septic in the wrong circumstances.
Yeah.
So it could be a really small wound or a massive wound, and some might get infected, some might not. But those are good things, isn't it?
I mean, I'm very grateful because I think everything shone really well for me.
Good.
And I healed really quickly. Yeah, it did. I just felt I've put everybody out, you know. And I thought at the time I was very pompous. But with hindsight, I'm not sure. Not sure I really was.
Was it always the decision, something like that, always the decision then to go by road? Or was it a case you weren't...
The crew arrived and you were still, I think, you put all, everything was in my arm. I think I was stable. The wound was cleaned. So you and I think Izzy were talking about, should we go to Southampton or Dorchester? And I was coming to then and said, please, Dorchester.
Yeah.
And then there was a decision about, you know, do you feel okay to go in the ambulance? And I was like, absolutely. 5-minute flight to Dorchester. As I say, I was in A&E for 3 or 4, maybe even longer hours. So it wouldn't have made...
And it's all weighing things up, actually. Now, so if things had been a lot worse for you, i.e. you had had a fracture with your large wound... Then our decision making would have been we'd probably go to Southampton.
Yeah,
that's not because Dorchester aren't a good hospital. It's because actually the orthopaedic surgeons, the plastic surgeons, and the people that do it more often are in Southampton.
Yeah.
So those are like for Izzy and I to have not mentioned Southampton as an option as a discussion point would have been wrong. And, and actually Dorchester was a completely reasonable thing for you to do. And some patients we may have even said, well, Southampton's not an option, but however, this is quite a large wound and the plastic surgeons live in Salisbury Hospital.
Right.
So actually flying you to Salisbury Hospital, which although is slightly out of your way and further from Dorchester, but if your wound was a lot larger, you needed maybe a small skin graft or something like that, then that's what they do mostly at Salisbury. So, and then we have an ability to move you in a minute rather than maybe an hour to Salisbury. So, and these are all things we're trying to weigh up at the same time.
And on this occasion, it worked out
perfectly.
Yeah,
and it's also what's right for you.
So
you've got to think about what's right for you medically, and also what's right for you and the ability for your wife and your daughter to come and see you sooner.
Because like, you guys said, rather than go and have a cut. You know, the whole, it's not just about managing me. I mean, obviously that's an issue, but it was about managing the whole situation.
Yeah.
You know, involving Beatrice in I think you got her holding the drips.
Yeah, got her holding
yourself. Oh, she's so important. Really, you know, she really appreciated that. And then when the decision was made, it was like, no, don't follow the ambulance. Go and have a cup of tea, get yourself together. And all those tiny things made so much difference.
Good.
Because she would have jumped in the car with nothing and no handbag, no phones, no nothing. She would have got there, no money to park. All those silly little things.
Yeah.
Well, actually, that half an hour made so much difference.
What we actually, I think, we ended up doing was, we grabbed Beatrice and hopped her over the fence.
You
and
did.
We showed around.
Pictures.
Yeah. Showed around the aircraft. I said, I'm really sorry, it's not the yellow one.
Yeah.
And you've seen bare aircraft yesterday at the air show. But we had a little look round and was able to chat to the pilot and ask questions, and it kind of maybe, I think it really helped.
I think that was good for us.
Gave them a little bit of time to comprehend what had happened and take a mind. Like, it's a helicopter now and I'm really close and they're letting me touch it. And, it's taken her mind off the fact that she just witnessed her dad have a horrible injury. And, and then it gave your wife some time just to kind of get back down and think about things, and then make your way to the hospital.
The interesting thing is she's done her nursing. She did her nursing degree. But the reality is, when you're personally engaged in something it's just completely different. It's like, if I cut myself, she's like, no, I can't go near it. And it's like, but you've done your nursing thing. And she's like, yeah, but I know you.
Claire Baker was very similar, actually. When she got injured playing rugby, didn't she? One of our own crew.
Yeah.
And she was in the land ambulance, I think, at the time, and she was given some, drugs by our team, and she was like, the same thing. She was like, it's not until it happens to you, that's one of us.
Yeah. But all of those skills are things you guys, bring to those situations.
Yeah, and I think, being a nurse myself, I've got friends that don't want anything to do with the stuff that I get up to on my trade, I don't want anything to do with what they get up to. And when it's your own loved one, it's even if it was my loved one in a circumstance that you can't possibly think of, it's a completely different ball game. You lose the medical mind, really.
Now, I remember you talking about your... Did you have a child?
No, Izzy does.
Izzy? Somebody was talking to me and I can't remember. It's funny, I remember some things very clearly, but other things I can't.
And it was a really hot day. I felt really sorry for you because it was really hot.
Well, it was embarrassing because I had my old shorts on and everything. And there's my wife taking pictures.
You were up in ladder.
I was only this high.
You weren't high at all.
No.
But it was absolutely roasting. And for whatever reason, you managed to land yourself directly where the sun was beaming.
That's right. Did you put a towel over my head or something? Somebody put something over me to shave.
We tried to get a cap. Yeah. I think we got a cap for you from her, but then we tried. Had to get I think we got Beatrice to hold a towel up here somewhere or something along, because it was literally, you managed to pick the right time of day that the sun was literally baking you.
Yeah.
And so not only have you got a massive cut in your leg.
I was did something.
You're on the floor. Yeah, you've probably been outside for a little while.
Yeah.
And you're literally just baking. I'm so sorry for you.
What happened was, as the step broke and I fell backwards, I got up and for what seemed like hours, but for a split second, looked at the bone and all the muscles, thought, wow, is that what they look like? They actually do look like those models.
Actually quite cool.
Yeah. And then it just went hell. It exploded. And bless Amanda. But as she came running down, and as I sat down, I rolled into that corner.
Yep.
That's not actually where I fell. I think I hopped. just with hindsight, it's just such a silly old thing. But these things happen.
Was the ladder up a wall or something?
We have a hedge. Doing the hedges. Because I think everyone thought the hedge cutter had gone through my leg.
Yeah.
I think that's what everyone thought.
That was one of the concerns.
But the step, And I stepped down and it just sheared through and flipped up. So as one foot went down, the thing, and I was on my way down and it was on its way up.
Mm.
So it's a fluke. And what actually happened is the bloke across the road is a retired gardener. If I'd have known he did that in the first place, I wouldn't be up the ladder. So, you know, all in, the easiest thing was not to have done it. Not, did you check your tools? Were you wearing boots? Were you did this? Did you step down? Why did it wobble? You know, all those things. The reality was, just should never have done it. It's just such a bargain. And when he did it the week after,
was it beautiful?
It was beautiful. Just fantastic, you know. So there you go. The lesson I learned was, at the end of the day, the first thing to decide is, do I really need to do this?
Yeah.
So there we go. And yeah, you know, with hindsight, the first decision was I didn't need to do it. So I've learned.
I can honestly say though, that is an everyday occurrence across the country, and people do a lot more risk averse things that are less risk averse.
I was two steps up the ladder, you know. It wasn't toppling on the top. Yeah,
but it's silly, but you're right. But like, most people
every summer across the south coast, how many people jump off tombstoning off cliffs and end up dead or badly injured? Like, the risk of doing that, well, that's probably quite good fun, compared to being on the second rung of the ladder with your hedge cutter, although you could have paid 20 quid. Is it like people are doing crazy things, properly crazy?
So, Owen, tell me, what's your background? How did you end up on the air ambulance?
So, I'm a nurse by background. I trained in Southampton and worked there for 6 years in Southampton. I started as a newly qualified nurse in the emergency department, so I did emergency care for just under 4 years, and then I moved into an intensive care role, which was a specialist role looking at, based on mostly technology, interestingly.
Right.
So technology and transfers. So Southampton's such a big intensive care unit. There's four different intensive care units: one for neurology, one for cardiac, one for pediatrics, and one for general. It's called general intensive care. So everything that doesn't fit into the other three. And I work for the technologist team for pediatric, cardiac, and general intensive care. And that role was, they're all clinicians, so nurses or paramedics or ODPs, so operation department practitioners. And actually, most of the team is that. And they look after all the ventilators, the monitors. They run special machines that filter your blood if it's got the wrong amount of potassium in, as an example, which is bad for your heart. So you can filter that out using an external machine. And they run that service. And they look after all the transfers in the hospital. So if you're really unwell, you need to go and have a scan to look at whether you've got bleed in your brain, then that team specialise in transferring you safely to the scanner, keeping you safe, and then bringing you back to your bed space to see your family safely, as well as driving and using all the technology in an ambulance to go and pick up sick children from the whole of the South Coast. So a big part of my role, and the team's role there, was to act as the regional transfer service for children who were really, really unwell. So we'd go around the whole of, interestingly, Wessex region, which is a deanery, which goes from Dorchester across to Chichester, up to just on the south edge of London, includes Basingstoke and Salisbury and that. And then at the weekends and at nights, we'd cover the Oxford Paediatric Intensive Care Patch.
Right.
It's a team called, the whole team's called SORT, or Southampton Oxford Retrieval Team. So the patch is massive. So some days on a Saturday, I'll be in Milton Keynes picking a sick child up, bringing them back to Southampton. And then throughout all that time in Southampton Hospital, and before university and at university, I've done work mostly on a voluntary basis within the ambulance service.
Right.
So I gained experience in pre-hospital care, to then building up over the years, and then a block of experience in hospital, to when this job came up here, I was able to apply for it, and luckily I was successful. Okay.
And what sort of qualifications do you need to be a paramedic on an air ambulance? Is it the sort of experience you've got, or are there specific training do you need?
So here's quite unique. Not unique, sort of necessarily the wrong word, because there are other ambulances in the country, but here we've got two nurses, as myself and Stuart, and then I need to do my maths, 13 paramedics actually. Right. Everyone's got a slightly different background and where they've got here. So I can't speak for him, but Dave, who's one of our new paramedics here, he's done a number of years on the road as a paramedic, and then he spent the last 2 years training as an advanced practitioner in an intensive care unit in a hospital.
Right.
So all of us have got some
different mixes,
really interesting, eclectic mixes of how we got here. So some people have been paramedics in the normal ambulance service for 10, 12 years and then have moved into this role. And so.
And do you enjoy it?
Yes. Yeah.
I'm sure it's exciting.
I don't know. It's a weird, for me, it's a weird situation to be in because the role of the critical care team for patients is to look after the people that are the most sick and injured.
Yeah.
And weirdly, that isn't necessarily a nice job.
Yeah. No, I understand that.
No, I'm just trying to explain it. But all of us here enjoy the aspects of looking after those patients.
Yeah, I don't mean in any way glorifying their misfortune, but
it's
the thing I took from seeing you all in action, and I mentioned to Tracy about Phil and how Phil scanned the area, saw I was in Nov, immediate, you had what you had, and he was like, I'll go and play with my aeroplane or something. The professionalism that came over, and the ability to separate, I suppose, the emotion that obviously was going around my family from what you needed to do, just came through so clearly, even though I was not quite aware. I just felt so comfortable because I think you mentioned to my wife, you made a comment about something, and she then said, yeah, I suppose that's my emotion speaking, not my what needs to be done here. And I think that professionalism just really
it made
me feel so comfortable.
That's one thing that a lot of patients come back with, they say is the professionalism and the calm, the way things just go, you know, it's like they're in safe, you're in safe hands, you've got the right people there.
But what I was trying to get at is, I think it's really difficult if you're a lay member of public with very limited knowledge about sort of the role that we do, because unfortunately, rightly or wrongly, and a lot of the work that we do, people, and you can relate that to helicopter ER, helicopter heroes, all the programs that are sort of 8 o'clock in the evening, 9 o'clock on constant repeat. And some of those may make or perceive our job to be really sexy, and what I was trying to get at is actually some of the work we do, although we get to fly around in a helicopter, that's just a mode of getting care to patients, and actually some of the stuff we do is not at all sexy. So I was trying to find words that it's an amazing job, but I wouldn't want to take away the fact that the job has some nice bits.
I do understand.
And that's really difficult to explain, because I think some people within the public, and I'm sure Tracy will back me here on that, is that their perception is purely on TV that play high-paced music.
Yeah.
And
But a lot of those programmes glamorise unfortunate circumstances. And again, it's funny, I watched one the other day through completely different eyes.
Yeah.
Complete. Not that I really get, I don't really like looking at that sort of stuff, because actually I'm a bit of a coward deep down. Oh, nice. So I don't like that, looking at people's misfortune. I think it's an age.
But it plays a massive part in getting the public to support around those charities, as much as, you know, the crew from their side, they probably look at it and go, well, we wouldn't do that. Or you see the starting shot and the crew are running to the aircraft, you know. That doesn't happen. that really does not happen. If they tripped and fell over, it would be, you know. But that doesn't happen. The calmness starts right as soon as they take that call. The calmness you feel at the scene is exactly the same here when they take a call.
Yeah.
You know, whoever's going wherever. Yeah. But those programmes are really important because they bring awareness of the charities and the services to the public out there. And, you know, what it's like, my mum will sit there and watch every episode probably. Yeah, and a number of people will do that. And it has done wonders.
The great thing it's done for a village like us is the issue that I said to a lot of people when they asked me, I said, what would have happened if that hadn't have been available? And it had been maybe I had gone through my leg with the strimmer or something like that. Actually, the emergency service that will get to us is the air ambulance.
Yeah.
This is an unusual thing to say, but actually, it's done a lot of good say, hang on a sec. And our immediate circle, it's raised the awareness. It's raised awareness. And I'm more than happy with that.
Yeah.
I'm more than happy
with that. I think it brings people into, not necessarily the real world, because everyone's living in the real world, but it makes you think, like, oh, if my family were unwell.
Yeah. A gentle reminder.
And actually, although you are rural, it's not that rural.
No.
And I don't know how long it would have to do the maths, but even if the weather was bad and someone was really sick in your village, it wouldn't take us long to drive there from here if the aircraft wasn't here. And
do you do that? Sorry, I didn't know you did that. So if the aircraft's down or weather's bad.
Yeah, so we're really lucky. The aircraft isn't offline for mechanical things very often, but we do live in the UK, so weather has a massive effect. And Dan or the pilots will be able to tell you more about that, but we're quite restrictive for safety reasons, quite rightly, on what sort of weather we can go flying in. So when we are within the limits or on the verge of the limits, depending on where you want to go, we won't fly, and that's to make sure that we go home to our families as well. Which is always a good thing. So when we can't do that, or if you live really closely to this airbase, so within sort of a 10-minute drive, then you might get us arriving in a car.
I saw the car outside. Yeah. I didn't know that. Yeah. I didn't know that. And is that all done by the trust as well, outside of the ambulance service?
So the cars are actually a partnership. It's all a partnership. And it's a really nice partnership between the ambulance service and the charity. And we get on really, really well as a group, actually. And so they help provide, we normally have two cars. We've got a van because one's off for servicing. But one car was provided through the charity and one car provided for the ambulance service. So there's always resilience that we can always respond. And the whole point is that their ambulance is, it's another vehicle that the car.
It's about getting the right skills to the scene. Going back to what we were saying, you're bringing the emergency department to you. And that's why you were saying earlier on about how sometimes things take a little bit longer. You're actually getting treatment from you're actually getting that at home or wherever you are straight away. So they're not going to, in the past maybe when maybe you've had and I shouldn't say just paramedics, they're not just paramedics, but previously we've flown with paramedics. So the skills right at the very beginning, skills on board the aircraft, were very similar to the skills that the guys on the road had. So they had no major difference, apart from they had an aircraft and they could get somewhere quicker. They could scoop a patient up, exactly what you were saying, put them in the aircraft and get them to hospital. There was no doctor on board, there was no critical care skills, they couldn't administer necessarily more powerful painkillers at the beginning. And then steadily, with investment from the charity, because of the great support we've had, we've been able to, number one, go for this aircraft, which is fantastic, which does make a big difference.
We need to make sure we go and see that quickly.
In case you get called.
Yeah. The phone goes.
It's Friday and lunchtime's approaching. Yeah. The traffic will build up.
Over the last 6 years, we've gone from having 4 paramedics to now something like 13 or 14 practitioners, so nurses and critical care paramedics, and something like 14 doctors, consultants. Wow. So do two shifts.
Let me ask Owen one question then.
Of course you can.
Do you actually like flying?
I like flying, yeah. luckily, yeah.
Yeah.
In reality, there's no better way to see, Dorset and Somerset. I find Dorset more beautiful than Somerset.
Yeah.
I have flown into Devon recently to support the Devon cruise. That's where I live, so I'm Devon's also a very nice place to fly.
Gosh, that's a trek for you, isn't it?
Yeah, but luckily we have an aircraft that can do that. We flew a long way and didn't have to fuel up, which was a great benefit for the patient and for the aircraft, for us, because in the machine that we flew to you in our reserve aircraft, we would have had to stop for fuel, which at night when airports start closing, and Exeter's quite lucky because it's open quite a lot, but when you go other places, airports close, you can't get fuel. And it's quite a big consideration. And
do you have to log your hours?
I don't know. Okay. The pilots do. And you're sure you probably know better than I do the restrictions that they have in place. And we'll get Dan out in a minute to show you around the aircraft.
Okay.
But yeah, so they've got really strict limitations on what hours they can work. And they're quite flexible in terms of if they work an hour over within the time limit, I think they can work only 12 hours per day.
Right.
And that's from start of shift. They have to land on it. They have to be on the helipad here or wherever they stop at the end of that shift.
Right. That's a long day.
But they work 10-hour shifts, so they've got a two-hour overlap.
Yeah, okay.
So very rarely do we need to get them to go it, or very rarely do they end up being back here 2 hours late.
Bless you, it was a Sunday afternoon. So it's every day. So what sort of shifts do you have to work?
So it's a 19-hour service here. So we work 7 till 5. The critical care team works 7 till 5. And then there's a 4 till 2 in the morning shift.
Right.
And the pilots work 7 till 5. And then 5 until 2. So they haven't got that hour overlap that we do. So it's 7 in the morning until 2 in the morning, 7 days a week. And then if the aircraft's not working, we'll still be here and we work on the car. And it's a great job. And yes, I do enjoy flying. I don't get to go to Durrell-Dour and places too often. And I feel very privileged to have had the opportunity to do this job.
What's next after this in career-wise?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know yet.
Sorry, putting you on the spot.
No. I honestly don't know. I think I am still young, despite the fact I'm trying to look a little bit older with a beard. if you look at my photo on the website, I need to get Tracy to change because I look about 12. I think I probably would look at staying here, but maybe reducing my hours and picking up hours back in the hospital.
Yeah.
Just because I've still got another 4 years in the NHS, ultimately, or whatever system that might be in the future.
Yeah. Who knows?
But, it would be a shame to completely lose my in-touchness with the hospital. And actually, part of our role here requires us to go into hospital because we're doing more invasive skills than...
Yeah.
The normal ambulance service are allowed to do because we've gone and done master's degrees in addition to what our standard of training has been, i.e. everyone's done a bachelor's degree, gone and done their job, and then we've gone to do master's, but then that's allowed us to give more drugs and provide more skills, work very closely with the doctors, and actually a lot of the jobs we do with the doctors here, we're completely interchangeable. Which is really, really cool. But to do that, we still need to pop into hospital and make sure we're keeping up to date with certain things. But for me, it'd be a shame coming from a hospital background to completely lose touch with certain things in the hospital.
Okay.
Let's go out.
All right, let's go and have a look.
Event Fire Solutions is an independent fire and rescue service providing both preventative and reactive emergency services across the UK. As well as our main event management, we provide the support and equipment to deliver a safe and risk-free event. From fire appliances to medical vehicles, our fully trained and accredited staff will make your event a true success. If you need risk-related advice, investigation, medical or fire training, then we can deliver this for you. From the office to the airfield, we have the experience and the accreditation and most of all the skills to make your workplace event safe and risk-free. To find out more of how we can help you, look us up at eventfiresolutions.co.uk.
Next, we went out to the aircraft with Owen to talk through the equipment in the cabin.
So if you're really poorly,
you would have ended up coming in here.
Yeah.
So we've got a stretcher for one patient, and then we've actually got four seats.
Okay.
Generally for us, if you're a small child, as an example, that you need your parent to come with you, then we'll normally have enough fuel and payload to do that.
It's amazing how big it is. I'm really surprised.
So this is why we've got the Augusta Western 169, is because it's so much space.
Yeah.
Now, it's a bit bigger and more complicated for Dan to fly compared to 902 that you had out to you, but the amount of space here, I can open one of our kit bags in this space and help do more with a patient, as an example. Whereas the little green one is... there's hardly any space in comparison. But this is the biggest HEMS aircraft at the moment.
Just tell us what you've got in terms of equipment in here. So
we've got our two main bags. Generally, they're split into a bag. One bag has all the stuff to look after people's airways and help them breathe. And then the next bag has things that help support their circulation and the defibrillator and the monitor that we use. So that's bag one and bag two split respectively. And then within the actual aircraft, we've got a load of oxygen so we can look after, keep people having oxygen as we fly to them to hospital. And then we've got things like a ventilator at the back, which mechanically ventilates you when we need to breathe for you. In the bags, we've got things that we can breathe manually, but this takes away that physical effort and is a lot better at doing it than we are, so we can use that to keep people breathing. And then we've got some on the back here, we've got some sort of what we call syringe drivers, so we can put drugs in there in a syringe, and it provides a continuous infusion of those drugs to you. So for example, when we put people to sleep for whatever reason, they need to be anaesthetized, and we can put a drug in into one of those, and it can keeps them asleep continuously without us having to remember, I need to give another drug at this time, and those sorts of things.
And it's accessible both sides as well.
So the only place we can't really get to is the patient's left hand foot side.
Right.
Their left hand leg.
Oh, right. Really. So they head here.
So head is up here. And your legs go down through the bridge. Yep. And then up here will sit the monitor. So,
okay.
All the patient's observations. So your heart rate, how much oxygen you've got in your blood, what rhythm your heart's doing, your blood pressure, all of that would sit here normally, but that lives in the bag because we take it with us everywhere.
Okay.
And then when we load you into the aircraft, we pop it up there, and then we can see it when we're flying along.
Okay.
And keep a good eye on that.
And how do you communicate with the pilot?
Yeah, so we all wear helmets, so the standard they're all alpha helmets, and all of us wear helmets. And then if the patient's conscious, so if we flew you as an example, you were conscious, we'd have just given you a headset so we can talk to you.
Okay.
So we'll always stay connected and we'll talk between us all. And at night time, there's always a pilot and always one of the practitioners sat in the left-hand seat all the time. So there's always two people at night. And then during the day, Dan can fly by himself if you've got a patient on board. So when we've got a patient, two of us will come in the back and we'll just be communicating with Dan. But yeah, we've all got, there's all these clips hanging down, which are the intercom system, and that also allows us with this box to speak to our control room, so we can always got constant communication. So Dan deals with all of the aviation radio contact, as you'd expect in all aircraft.
But you can speak directly to your control
In the back, and Dan can do it if he switches channels, but the responsibility to speak to ambulance controls hours in the back.
Okay.
So we do all of that. And there's communication, so we're not talking over each other. So when Dan's talking to our traffic control, we're all quiet and we don't answer radio calls. And the same thing with takeoff and landing. So when Dan or respective pilots are working really much harder to control the aircraft and they're using a lot of overload, we just get rid of all the radio calls, so we're not talking to anyone.
Right,
so it's kind of that sterile cockpit idea.
Yeah, okay.
Because the landings, although we stay legal within the limits of the aircraft and what the CAA say we can do, but that still means that you all might be landing on a motorway, as an example, and you're having to make sure the traffic has actually stopped, the police have closed the road, as an example. So you've always got to have your wits about you. And like your paddock behind your garden, it's making sure that you're clear of the trees, and that if there's, like, as an example, so it's perfectly big enough, it's massive, but the trees at all. So it's making sure that between us, that we, if there's a problem, we can have in takeoff and landing, that we can say, you need to move right, go back down, all those sorts of things.
Yeah.
At the same time, if the helicopter has a problem, that Dan can solve those issues.
Yeah, okay.
Now that's just the main kit, and then in the boot we've got a load of stuff. Cheers, Dan.
Right. Didn't realise it had a boot.
Yeah, it's got quite a luxurious boot. Our handy engineer can actually sit in the boot like an Indian, and there's a good photo to evidence that.
Okay. Oh wow. Okay. Yeah.
So it's a massive boot, actually. And in here, additional things that we don't use every time, but certain patients benefit from certain bits of equipment. So here you've got blood. So in these little, very specially designed boxes, they keep blood cool. For 48 hours.
Okay.
Pretty cool. And Dorchester County, Dorset County Hospital in Dorchester, that looked after you, provide the blood products for us and support us really well on that. And there's another charity called Tiger Moths for you.
How annoying.
That's all right. A beautiful aircraft. So Dorset County Hospital provides blood, and then there's a charity called Devon Free Wheelers that bring that blood out and distribute it up to us for free, and they do that every 2 days. And when it's been really hot over the summer, it's actually been changed daily just to ensure that we keep the blood as cool as possible, because what happens is it then goes back to Dorset County Hospital, and then it gets then put back into blood transfusion, so we don't waste any blood. It's still available for patients should they need it. And then other things, we've got a warmer, so for blood and fluid, so things, if you're really unwell, we want to make sure that they go into you at the same temperature we run at, so 37 degrees. We've got a machine that can do chest compressions for us, not because we're lazy, but because it's better at us when we're moving across fields and downstairs and all those sorts of things. Because we're quite a rural place, so you might go to people that have collapsed on cliffs. And this just acts as an extra person. And then some other generic things like splints for people who fractured their legs, and straps to secure people onto the scoot stretcher that we use to immobilise patients that have got spinal injuries, as an example.
Wow.
But it lives in the boot, and then if we go to someone that suffered a trauma, so if you needed blood then and we flew you, we would put all the blood in the back and would use it if we need it. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, no, I understand. Wow, didn't realise.
Yeah, it's kind of hidden in here, it's quite nice.
Hi, I'm Mick Oakey. I'm the managing editor of The Aviation Historian, and you're listening to Extended.
Next, I got to talk to Dan Kitteridge, who was the pilot on duty when I visited. He talks us through flying the Augusta Westland 169, call sign HeliMed 10.
Hi there, so my name's Dan Kitteridge. I'm one of the pilots here at Dorset Somerset Air Ambulance. Been flying helicopters for about 20 years. Before this, I was in the Navy for 16 years, and for the last sort of 4 to 5 years, I've been flying in the air ambulance role. Before here, I was over at Kent, Surrey, Sussex, but for the last year and a half, I've been here at Dorset and Somerset and been flying the 169, which is this aircraft that we've got in front of us here, for the last sort of year, just over a year from now that we've been operating it.
Okay. So you're a Fleet Air Arm pilot?
Ex-Fleet Air Arm, So
what were you flying for the Fleet Air Arm?
I was flying Sea Kings, so in comparison to this, a lot older aircraft. The Sea King sort of dates back to sort of the late 1960s technology, whereas this, the 169, is much more up-to-date, so a fair bit quicker and a lot more sophisticated in terms of what we can actually do with the aircraft.
Right. Now, the aircraft that came to me was the Explorer.
Mm-hmm.
You fly both aircraft?
Yes, we're dual rated on both types of aircraft, and that gives us the ability that if this aircraft, the 169, goes in for major servicing, then in its place comes a 902 Explorer, which you obviously had an encounter with, and we're able to actually carry on providing the service using that aircraft.
Right. So explain to me what this beautiful bird is. She's so impressive. It's so much bigger than I thought. I mean, I've seen lots of helicopters, I've been in lots of helicopters, but she's big.
It is. And if you go back to the start of air ambulances, and that's sort of the late 1980s in this country.
Yeah.
Charities were typically using aircraft like the Bolco, which was about a third of the size of this aircraft. And then later on, we come to the 1990s, and we're talking about the 902 Explorers. And then this, the very latest generation of aircraft, the 169, is again a step on. So it's about 4.5 tons in weight, and it has a top speed around about 160 odd mile an hour, which again is a step on from the previous generations of aircraft, which means we're able to get to patients quicker and get them to hospital quicker. It can stay airborne for longer. We're typically looking at endurances of in excess of 2 hours with this aircraft.
Wow.
Whereas to take those steps backwards at the start of air ambulances, it was much less. So an hour and a quarter, hour 20 minutes. So this really is a sort of step on.
And so it's mission capability so much greater.
Very much so. And also in terms of the instrument flying that we can actually carry out, it's a very sophisticated, a touch of a few buttons, I can bring up any sort of airport with any runway approach, etc., and stuff like that. So there's lots of things that we can do with it that enable us to carry out our mission here a lot more effectively.
Now, it's a glass cockpit.
Yes.
No steam gauges.
No.
tell us a little bit about its capabilities, because you fly at night as well, don't you?
Yeah, we operate the service till 2 o'clock in the morning here at Dorset and Somerset. And so with all the technology that this aircraft brings, it enables us to do that a lot more sort of safely with a greater degree of capability than we would have otherwise had with older generation aircraft. So, which is great news for me, because it means my workload becomes less, because the aircraft is able to sort of present a lot of information to me on those screens that I need to actually carry out the job.
And it is single pilot, isn't it?
It's single pilot, but all our paramedics are trained up to be what we call technical crew members, so they can assist with operating a lot of the aircraft systems, help me out with navigation, all things like that, which again eases my workload and enables me to just concentrate on flying the aircraft whilst they help me with that workload up the front.
Right. So typical day you arrive, what's in getting the aircraft ready for its mission?
It's a really good question, because there is no such thing as a typical day, but to give you the sort of the loose framework of what we do, we will come in around about 7 o'clock in the morning, such that the aircraft gets checked over thoroughly, what we call a check A on the aircraft. And then we aim to have the aircraft sat out here on dispersal, ready to go by no later than 7:30 in the morning. Okay, right. And from then onwards, you know, the phone can ring at any time. Yeah. We aim to get airborne during the day within about sort of 3 to 5 minutes of that call coming in.
Okay.
Whereas at night time, we actually carry out a little bit of flight planning, because we need to know exactly where we're going to position that aircraft, where we're going to land.
Yeah.
And as you can appreciate, at night, trying to sort of locate hazards such as wires, obstacles, things like that. We need to carry out that flight planning by night in order to make that particular flight as safe as it possibly can be.
Wow, okay. And in terms of hazards like lines and things like that, is there a particular skill that helimed pilots have? Because it's you know, even where I lived, my biggest fear was, God, trees, lines, how the goodness...
I mean, we're using all the basic skills that any helicopter, any aviator will use, and the most important, which is lookout. We're looking at where we're going the whole time, and so is the rest of the crew that we fly with.
Yeah.
And any pilot, be they sort of a PPLH, a PPLA, a commercial pilot, you know, will spend years and years training about sort of looking out for those observational hazards. So there's nothing sort of above and beyond what we're doing. There are sort of certain elements of kit that we are using, which is fairly specialised, such as the night vision goggles, which again enable us to sort of have a greater appreciation of what's going on at night outside the aircraft.
And they're always worn at night, are they?
They are, yes, both for the front seats and the back seats. The people, our crew down the back, have also got night vision goggles on as well. And we're very lucky we fly with the very latest generation MVIS equipment. Which again enables us to just carry out that mission as safely as we possibly can.
In terms of preparing the aircraft, a question I didn't ask because I see a fuel tanker here. Who fuels the aircraft? Is that something that you would do?
We as a crew, yeah, we're all trained to actually carry out the refueling on the aircraft, which means that as soon as we get back from a job, we can actually go to work readying the aircraft for its next flight. The medical team also in conjunction will be restocking any elements of their kit that need to be replenished. And so the aim of the game is to be back online if the phone goes straight away again.
Okay. The one thing I took from the helicopter, although the size of it is slightly daunting to me, actually, its rotorblade footprint isn't that big, is it?
No, and that's quite deliberate. That's why the charity, along with others, selected this aircraft. We don't want something that's not going to be able to get us in as close to the patients that we need to see as quickly as possible. So the rotor blades, in comparison to other aircraft, are perhaps shorter, sort of smaller rotor disc, if you like, which enables us, hopefully, to land as close as we possibly need to be to the scene of the incident that we're attending.
And in terms of currency for the aircraft and for the Explorer, what sort of qualifying exercises do you have to go through to keep you rated?
Yeah, we're in addition to sort of your annual license checks, if you like, we're subject to sort of 6 monthly operational performance checks. We're subject to annual line checks, and these are both by day and night. We're subject to check flights, so looking at our instrument flying skills. So in answer to your question, it never ends. It is pretty rigorous to make sure that we're constantly honing the skills that we need, that we might be called upon to actually sort of again, you know, carry out the flight nice and safely. So yes, we are looked at very regularly, and we practice all the time as well, in addition to the flying that we're doing on a day-to-day basis, which keeps those skills up to speed.
And in terms of there's no common day, I do get that. Is there anything that stands out in terms of some of the incidents you've been to that have been really challenging in terms of flying?
In terms of flying, it can get very, very busy, particularly when we're going into sort of controlled airspace and you're having to liaise very closely with the agencies that you're coming into contact with, who I have to say do an absolutely outstanding job of letting us get to those incidents as quickly as possible, and deconflicting us with other traffic. So that's something that we have to, you know, be very, very much focused on from the front end. It's very easy to you know, potentially get sucked into the incident that you're attending whilst also not paying attention to those basic airmanship skills, and that has to be at the forefront of our mind, and indeed it is. So that can be a challenge at times. Selecting the landing site is also something that, obviously, particularly by day, we have no prior knowledge. Me talking to you now, the phone could go now, I don't know where I'm going. Within 10 minutes I could be landing on a motorway.
So how does that work then? The call goes, how does the I suppose the location and the the routing and that come to you? Are you given coordinates?
Well, the routing's kind of down to me, but they will actually pass the details of that call to either the paramedic that gets the phone call, and he will actually verbalise over the phone where it is in terms of the general area that we're going to. That's enough to get me going towards the aircraft. So for instance, if they were to say Bournemouth, I know to walk to the aircraft, start it up, and I know which general direction that I'm heading. That information then gets transferred onto an iPad with a detailed description, obviously, of exactly where we are going, so we can actually see on the map, and we can also put that information into the aircraft. And so between all of those devices as well, we know where we're going, we know what we're attending, and I'll be working with that technical crew member, the paramedic or the doctor that's sat up front, to get us to that incident as quickly as possible.
Sorry, didn't know where you were going on a call then.
It doesn't matter where we are.
So in terms of interacting with air traffic control and the other authorities, this is this an uncontrolled airfield?
This is an unlicensed airfield. So there is not sort of, you know, it's not sort of Class A airspace or anything, or even Class D airspace. But we do speak to the air traffic over there just as a ground radio station, just so that people have awareness of us going in and out. Because as you can appreciate, at things like weekends in the summer, it can be quite a busy place. So everyone's, you know, on the radio. videos saying what they're doing, and we make sure that we deconflict with any of the other users, because as you can see, we've got tiger moths buzzing around. There's other fixed wing users, so the last thing we want to do is, particularly with the downwash that this aircraft creates, is go playing through the middle of that.
And we've got Yeovilton to the west of us.
Correct,
we've got Bournemouth International. So there is some restricted air zones as well. How does that work?
Well, it's a case of good communication with those agencies, and they understand. If I'm operating, our normal call sign is HeliMed 10, and if we're under a HeliMed 10 Alpha, that Alpha call sign tells air traffic that we're actually on a job, therefore they know that we're actually trying to get to the scene of an incident, and we'll pass them details of where we're looking to go. It's not an automatic right for us to just go ploughing through and getting in the way of other users, but it does mean that air traffic know that we're actually on a job, and they do their level best to actually ask other air traffic to deconflict with us. And as I have to say, we're very, very lucky down here in the, both Bournemouth, Bristol, or if we're down Exeter way, they, and across the country, really, everyone knows that we're actually going to a particular location for a good reason, and they do their absolute level best to enable us to get there as quickly as we can.
That's a lot of frequencies, isn't it? To transit, potentially, military, civil, unlicensed.
It can be. It can be quite busy, but I mean, this aircraft enables us to sort of really stay sort of, you know, one step ahead in that we've got two radios on board, both with an active frequency, a standby frequency, so you can kind of get your ducks in a row for what is likely to happen next, such that it can follow a sort of logical sequence of events.
Hey, listen, it's getting busier and busier as we speak. There's more people around, so thanks very much for
your
time.
You're very welcome. No,
thanks
worries.
A lot.
Cheers.
At this point, the crew were called out to an emergency in Bournemouth, and I watched their departure. Finally, we get to talk to Bill Sivright, Chief Executive Officer, and Tracy Bartram, the Communications Manager, who tell us how this operation all comes together.
My name is Bill Sivright. I'm Chief Executive Officer for Dorset and Somerset Air Ambulance.
And I'm Tracy Bartram. I'm the Communications Manager for Dorset and Somerset Air Ambulance.
Well, Tracy, Bill, thank you so much for having me today.
Pleasure.
It's been an amazing day for me in so many ways. But the most important thing that's come to me throughout all of this is how critical this service is to areas such as mine. How important is it that we have an air ambulance?
Well, I suppose you have to go back a little bit in time to really gauge how important it is. I mean, it all started in the UK, you know, 30-odd years ago, with one air ambulance down in Cornwall. The community actually wanted the air ambulance because, I mean, the road infrastructure down there is not ideal for getting, you know, fast cars and ambulances around. So they wanted to make up for that, and a helicopter seemed an obvious solution to them. And the success of that in the early days, of course, meant that others wanted to follow suit.
Yeah.
Now, we live in Dorset and Somerset. We're here right on the border of Dorset and Somerset at Henstridge. No motorways in Dorset. The road infrastructure, I'm not criticising the road infrastructure, but it's quite torturous sometimes. Just going, if you're crossing the grain of the country by road, that's a real challenge. And we service a lot of rural communities who, not surprisingly, feel isolated. And I mean, we know now much more about medicine. I mean, the advances in medicine have meant that we now understand better what urgent and immediate care can mean and the difference it can make. I mean, if you consider it in terms of a broader strategic view of health economy, it's recognised that the earlier you can intervene with a patient, either for the serious medical condition or trauma, the chances of survival are increased. I mean, the statistics from the trauma network say that one in four will survive that wouldn't have survived previously. Mm. I mean, that's a significant figure. Well, of those that survive, the speed with which they can be returned to either full health or approaching full health, and how quickly they can do that is also increased. And that means that people aren't staying in hospital as long as they did.
Yeah.
And beds in hospitals are extremely expensive and, of course, impact on all the other people who need those beds. So our impact, although in your case, we are absolutely thrilled that we were able to help you, but actually we've helped a whole load of other people who are now get a hospital bed that you weren't taking up.
Yeah, and the service is a charity. It's a charity that delivers this service.
Yes.
How important is that, and how important is it to rely on the donations that people, organisations, and stakeholders make?
Well, I think, I mean, it's a question that we get asked quite regularly, and I think it's a reasonable question to say, well, the government pays for ambulance services and hospitals, so why doesn't it pay for an air ambulance? But I think statistics help here to understand where we are with that. If you consider that last year, the ambulance service here in the southwest handled just under 1 million calls. So, in the high 900,000s of incidents attended, we were called to 1,197 of those.
Wow.
So that's a fraction of their total bill.
It's still a lot. I didn't realise it was that many.
Well, it's grown considerably. I mean, we've seen our numbers grow, and that's been part of our strategy, is to try and reach many more patients than we may have done previously. The point is that you make yourself more efficient, you make yourself more resilient, so that you can do that. But just going back to that point about the charity versus government funded, we spend our donors' money directly on things that will assist a patient. We spend very little on bureaucracy.
Mm.
If you look at our charitable spending over the last 8 years, it's grown. Our income has doubled. It has more than doubled. Mm. We've gone from £3 million to £8.5 million. Our charitable spending on the actual mission itself has gone from under £2 million to now to just under £4 million.
Wow.
And it's still growing. We've gone from 4 paramedics to now 14 critical care practitioners and 13 consultants. That's senior doctors, skilled in anaesthetics and so on. And it's all been part of a plan. It's the master plan. Mm. Now, we wouldn't have been able to do that if we were building an organisation that was servicing a government requirement, because they would have been second guessing everything. Now, this is not being critical of government. It's true of any large body.
Its agility is not
exactly. We can identify something we need to do. We create a business case. We don't do anything. It's not done on the fly. There's a business case created. If it's for new equipment, we have to have that. Our governance of our clinical operation is done by the ambulance service. So anything that we are proposing to do in terms of new equipment or procedure, we have to make sure that they are comfortable with that.
Right.
So once that's done, I come back to trustees with this business case. There's a cost. There's the benefit that's clearly stated. There's the sign-off by SWAS that actually they'd be happy to support us in that effort. And the decision is taken to either do it or don't do it.
Right.
And I have to say, we're really fortunate. We have chosen to take steps which others either can't take or have taken a different direction. But we're convinced now that we're on the right path.
Yeah.
But we're not finished yet.
Okay. What's to come? What still needs to be done, Bill?
Well, we've focused most of our attention on the direct contact with the patient, because we had to get that right.
Yeah.
So In the olden days, or I think the common term these days is in the day, back in the day.
Back in the day.
The term that was often bandied about was the golden hour. And it was recognisable at that point as the golden hour was the time at which we could get a patient to hospital. Actually, that's not what the golden hour really means. It's getting the patient to definitive care. Well, we now take definitive care to the patient.
Yeah, I found that.
The clock stops the minute we're there. And that's really important because it means that actually, going back to that point about the health economy and the earliest intervention, that intervention is now hours sometimes earlier than it might otherwise have been. So that's quite key. So we've worked very hard towards that. And we now take, in effect, an A&E department to the patient.
And Tracy, how important is getting that message over to the public? Because I am a prime example of not really appreciating quite the service until I desperately needed it.
Well, I think I think it's imperative that we get that message across to the public in whichever way we can. We are so fortunate that a number of patients like yourself that have been affected by the service and been treated by the crew decide that they personally want to come back and say thank you or bring cakes like you did, which is amazing, and they taste really nice.
It's cakes for your meeting, Bill.
and obviously decide possibly to share their story or for enable us to share it with other people, because it's not until we can explain to others out there the work that the team did to potentially save someone's life or potentially help them quicker than it would normally have been possible. It's massive. Being able to communicate things like this is great.
We don't make Tracy's job easy. The reason is that the last thing we want, and I'm speaking now for our clinicians as well as the charity as a whole, is to glamorise what they do. I'm reinforcing that point. I wasn't present.
I wasn't aware of it, really, to be fair.
The last thing we want to do is to appear to be these angels. It's not about that.
Bill, you were for me, I can assure you. I know what you mean.
This is all about the patient. I mean, we have an interesting little helicopter, which is the single focus, and I know that the audience this is destined for will be very interested in the helicopter itself. But the helicopter isn't the thing for us in reality. The helicopter is an ideal vehicle for what we do, but we've got to be prepared to do it in any vehicle.
So we
talk about the important thing is it's critical that we're there. We get there, however we get there, that the critical care team, with all that capability, can reach the patient. It is going back to that point about the patient. It's not about anything else. Our growth in terms of what we spend and so on has all been in the clinical delivery. So we're focused very much on contact with the patient. We then thought, well, actually, we need to make sure it's pointless us developing our capability to the nth degree and then leaving a patient for 4 hours in a queue at A&E. That just wouldn't make sense. And people would very quickly, bore with that as an idea. So we also worked at the very outset to create relationships with the acute trusts, the hospitals. And that relationship now has reached a point of trust with a small t, where there's a collegiate relationship between our crews and the people in the acute trust, so that if our crew determine that a particular course for a patient, a pathway is how it's referred to, is required, they'll recommend it, and by and large that's what will happen. So we're increasingly taking patients not to A&E but to the cath lab. For instantly having a stent, or into a theatre, or for scans, and that's for the patient. I mean, that is just incredible, the life chances that are brought with that. So we've focused very much in that area. We're now looking at, okay, what can we do to make the air ambulance service that we deliver even better? Do more of it, or, you know, but actually we're reaching the limits of what we can reasonably achieve. We're looking at 24 hours and the possibility of that and the benefit that might bring. We haven't concluded yet whether that extra 5 hours will make such a difference. But what if we could reduce the number of patients that we get called to anyway, so that the ones that really need us, we're there for. Health initiatives,
health awareness,
safety, accident and injury prevention in the first place, helping a first responder in a situation where someone has a cardiac arrest, that critical CPR or a defibrillator being used locally can make the difference when we get there of whether we can save that life or not. So how can we support them? So we're now looking at ways in which we can support other organisations to do their bit to make our bit even more effective. And at the other end of the scale, we've just taken on two we call them patient and family liaison support personnel, and their role is to effectively get alongside the patient as they leave our care. So they will track the patient through hospital and beyond. Now, you might argue, well, there are other organisations doing that, and that's true, but never with quite such a focus that we can bring. Let me give you an example that will really bring that to light. If someone suffers from an amputation, for instance, lower limb amputation, they will probably be taken to a major trauma centre, and will then go on somewhere else, perhaps, for rehabilitation. Well, when they come back to a local village in Somerset or Dorset, they might at that point think that's their life over. They're the only ones in the village with that amputation, and the connection with others who have been through similar circumstances is limited. Now, there are lots of organisations out there who will be working hard to try and help them, but putting it all together is a challenge. Well, our patient liaison personnel will follow them through and will be able to do that for them. And not only that, put them at part of our network of people who have had similar injuries in this area. So that will be of life benefit for them.
Fascinating. How can people learn more about the work you do? How can they support you? How can they get involved if they want to?
There's a number of ways that people can do that. I mean, our website is the first place, probably, and the best place that people can get a first look if they don't know exactly what we do. Our website's a great place to go.
What's the address?
It's www.dsairambulance.org.uk.
Okay.
So there's a huge amount of information on there. There's ways that people can get involved via fundraising, so there's lots of ideas on there. You can donate direct to the charity from that website as well. You could create a fundraising page, so you look so much better. It's about time you did a marathon, or at least some type of challenge. And we can help you. Obviously, you can set your own fundraising page up via the website. And then obviously we've got things like all our social media. So we've got Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. Right. And we're at DS Air Ambulance on there. So that's really easy to find us. And we have a magazine and we have a lottery. So if you read our magazine, you will know about our lottery. But our lottery is obviously the biggest fundraiser for the charity.
Right.
And it's £1 a week. Are you a member yet?
No.
Right, okay.
We were members.
Were you?
We dropped off the radar.
Okay, we're going to drop you back on.
Yeah.
So that's £1 a week, which is nothing, is it?
No, we used to do it. We don't even know quite how that...
Interesting point about the fundraising pages, because other brands are available when it comes to doing online fundraising.
Yeah.
What I would say about doing it directly through our website is that all the money, including the gift aid, if people give it, comes direct to us. There's no fees associated with it. It goes to another organisation, which sometimes happens.
Yeah.
People may not be aware of. So actually creating that fundraising page on our website, we get all the donation.
Right.
We're quite pleased. That's quite a recent innovation for us.
Yeah. I'd like personally to thank you for writing to us, for contacting us, because, you know, we only get to find out how patients are doing.
Yeah.
Or in the past we have. Obviously the patient liaison clinicians will help, hopefully, in that process as well. But we it's not until you make contact with us that we get to find out how you are.
Right. So it's important people out there make contact as well.
Absolutely.
Because patient confidentiality is still key.
No, I get that.
So we have never known. And I should make the point that these patient liaison staff are clinical staff.
Yeah.
They will not automatically share information with the charity.
No, I understand.
That is absolutely
patient confidential.
Yes. So, but of course, with their relationship, one hopes that the decision to contact us will come more quickly.
Hmm.
But we have relied heavily on people coming back so that we can tell the story.
Yeah.
Social media has really helped us in that sense. I personally, I'm not a great fan of social media.
And I love it. So do you, I hear.
It's the world we're in, isn't it?
Well, yes, and I recognise I'm a dinosaur. But I'm the first to say that the social media has really lit the blue touch paper as far as gaining the stories, which are really important to tell. To go back to your question, you know, how do people, you know, they don't know about this. Well, telling the stories is a great way of getting that out there.
Well, I can only say thank you so many times, but thanks again for everything that you and the charity have done.
I'm glad we were there.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
Okay, I'd like to thank the whole team at the Dorset and Somerset Air Ambulance for their response to my incident, but also for opening their doors to give us an insight into the operation of the Air Ambulance service. You can find Dorset and Somerset Air Ambulance at dsairambulance.org.uk. Please do anything you can to support them, remembering this is a charity delivering a crucial emergency service. You can also find them on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their support for Extended. This programme is produced under a Creative Commons licence, so please do ask before using anything you hear. You can find Gareth at Gareth_Stringer on Twitter, and you can find Tim at RAESTimR on Twitter. And if you want to talk to me on Twitter or follow me, you can find me at Nascot Hornet. Thank you to all who have sent good messages and best wishes to me over the past 2 months. I've healed perfectly and I'm very, very grateful for all your kind thoughts and support. But if you want to do something for Extended, please leave us a review on iTunes and on our Facebook page. Everything you do to support the programme does help us. So remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
This is XTP Media.